This evening we wish to consider the problem of the relationship between science and what we call scientific materialism. In order to get the necessary perspective, we have to realize that in the progress of Western culture, man moved very gradually but relentlessly from a theistic to a humanistic foundation. The division in time is rather uncertain. There were both theists and humanists in Greece and in the Roman Empire. But we may say, for general purposes, that modern humanism began in the early 17th century following the Reformation, which more or less cleared the way for free thinking, and then gradually, slowly, and at first rather painfully, advanced its own purposes, which were consummated in both political and intellectual revolutions. The humanistic position rose in importance as man advanced in his knowledge of the natural sciences. In ancient times, scientific principles were known, but they were known much as religious principles were known. They were held as convictions by the learned. There was hardly enough available methodology to permit the scientific approach to knowledge that we know today. But in the 18th and later, more intensely, in the 19th century, the organization of human knowledge passed gradually into the keeping of astronomers, biologists, physicists, and to a measure, psychologists. During this time, the struggle between religion and the rise of science was a very keen struggle. And in the United States particularly, this struggle continues even till now. While it is true that psychologically science has come to more and more dominate our intellectual lives, religion still plays a very large and positive part. And the family of the scientist may be devout in some faith, and even the scientist himself may acknowledge a nominal allegiance to some religion. In the vanguard of the scientific motion, of course, there were extremists. And in humanism, these extremists took a totally materialistic point of view, and we have gradually come to know them either as rather rabid agnostics or actual atheists. In the 20th century, atheism came into fashion in the Western world. It remained fashionable, however, only in certain groups, and its influence was limited to a level of intelligence that was deeply immersed in the advancement of scientific knowledge. We cannot say that, generally speaking, religion has been heavily penalized in the United States, for example, in the rise of science. Perhaps religion, however, has come under a certain negative disfavor. And in higher education especially, we find today skepticism as a basic symbol of intellectual maturity. The individual who believes is held to be unscientific. Gradually also, there arose this peculiar demarcation by which all knowledge was divided into fact and fantasy. Science became the custodian of fact, and all other forms of learning, religion, art, culture, aesthetics, idealism, all of these were grouped together under the general heading of fantasy. Perhaps we can go even further and say that there is this division between science and superstition. What we have not realized is that no such dichotomy exists in nature. Nature does not say, this is fact and this is fancy. Nor does it divide the different areas of knowledge by any arbitrary intellectual boundary. We might have been a little better off in this rising tide of factualism had we had more facts. But unfortunately, even in science, there is not enough broad area of fact to be able to clearly say that many borderline mysteries are either so or not so. We cannot say, actually, that science possesses all the facts. And while a fact-finding body does not possess the necessary facts, its findings must be advanced with modesty. Science has overlooked this modesty, and at least some of its representatives have gone out to a very difficult and dangerous position. They have taken it for granted that science was the sole custodian of true knowledge, that all forms except those within the acceptances of science, all forms of knowledge, which science did not bless with its particular benediction, were worthless, valueless, and meaningless. Now, of course, scientists do not say this, really, because they are always in need of new laboratories. And for the most part, the laboratories are built by these superstitious people who still have faith in something. And some of them even have faith in the scientists. This type of situation also sometimes makes us wonder if such faith is not a little superstitious. But in any event, the struggle in the United States has been a slow one. And probably around 1920 or shortly thereafter, the rise of Russian communism resulted in the gradual arising here of a certain type of American, quite a sincere, honorable citizen, who did, however, have a certain cause in common with the Russian Bolsheviks and anarchists. He was dissatisfied. He was one of those who had read enough, perhaps, of Karl Marx to come to the conclusion that most human misfortunes were due to too much theology. He gradually came to associate religion with stagnation, with the constant persecution of progress. And he also liked, perhaps, to agree with Karl Marx that most of the common social sins of mankind are due to religion blocking the natural inquiry of the human mind. Being in this sense of the word a bit of a rebel in his own right, he gradually gathered others of his kind to become what might be termed campus atheists. They were young people. They were sincere. They were knight errants with not much of a cause, but they were doing the best they could. They felt, as many young people do, that they must fight for something. And today, in our way of thinking, when you fight for something, you must also fight against something. So by degrees, this group, growing older, got into some rather strategic positions, and little by little, the scientific world began to feel the pressure of these not mature, thoughtful atheists, but mostly just disillusioned people who, not having found God particularly interested in them, decided that they no longer had any interest in God. It was all rather amateurish, but it did produce a rather deep scar in our way of life. And this scar we still have to struggle with, because it has gradually indoctrinated a large part of our educational theory. And particularly in higher education, we are at least indirectly inspired to believe that we should not believe in anything except science and education. It has been, as we say, a slow fight, and I reiterate this for a particular purpose. I want to keep reminding you that this struggle was up and through a nominally religious world. In this country, the little white churches have always been dotted throughout our communities. And contrary to many other countries, the young as well as the old were deeply devout in their religious allegiances. Today, we probably have a very strong religious body in the United States. It is estimated at the approximately 90 million of our people. So, actually, science never had its perfect works with us. It never was able to get completely rid of this superstition and build its own kind of a world. It was never able to completely escape the need for diplomacy, for caution, and for moderation of attitude. And perhaps this in some ways helped the scientist to keep a little more middle ground. Also here, we do not suffer very much from religious persecution, and the old superstitions against which the humanists first hurled their thunder are not of enough importance in our way of life now to form very much of an enemy. So science did not have very much of a case. It had no particular need to attack anyone terribly because no one was doing anything that was particularly awful. Thus, the situation sort of dwindled. And we come down to the year 1962 with a rather interesting and somewhat confusing picture in the relationships between science and the everyday life of our people. Also, we have to realize that scientists do get together, that they have their own arguments and discussions, that they are not really quite as certain of themselves as perhaps the press suggests. Perhaps they have had a certain aura of infallibility bestowed upon them, but they do not wear it with any great amount of real comfort. They are not too certain of their own position in many matters. One thing they have learned, however, within the last 15 years, and that is that science can be extremely dangerous. Now, they found this out in a world in which science is not even dominant. It has made a certain allegiance with policy in matters of armament. It has made an allegiance with society in matters of health and hygiene. It has made an allegiance with industry in terms of the advancement of a mechanistic way of life. And it has certainly dabbled strongly in the economy of the nation. But still, the scientist is only a scientist, and around him moves a world with many other factors. He felt rather good about everything until he began to explore more deeply into his electronic mysteries. Here he found he was getting a little out of control. And I know from talking to a number of these men that they're not quite comfortable. They're not so much worried about themselves. They are pretty well sure, each one of them, that is a man of honor. But they're wondering about the others. They're wondering about what the scientist in the next laboratory is doing. Is he also honorable? Is he beyond the temptations which common folks suffer from? And out of the entire situation has come the sobering thought that science is getting hold of information and methods which are very dangerous, critically dangerous. And the scientist does now what he did 20 years ago. He tries to disclaim responsibility for the use made of his own discoveries. He says that he is going to turn them over to other people whose specialty is morality and ethics, and that these should administer his discoveries. But he forgets to tell us that during the course of education, he himself warned young people not to study morality and ethics, but to get down to the good hard facts of biology and physics. So we have some pretty good biologists, and some pretty good physicists, but the enrollment in the ethics and culture courses has not been up to date very good. It's like the course in philosophy. The university may have a department of science with 200 instructors and a department of philosophy with five, three of them on the verge of retiring. This is the situation as we have had it. Now everyone wonders why. We also feel, however, that because of the slow encroachment of science, and because there is still a large reservoir of faithful and devout persons in this Western world, that we may be able to absorb the shock of scientific progress and still keep our heads. We have therefore seen only a slowly conditioned advance in this area. Now, on the other side of the Atlantic, our communist competitors have had an entirely different background. And this is rather intriguing. After the Bolshevik Revolution and the gradual rise of the Soviet republics, the scientist found himself in an almost perfect atmosphere. He found himself in a country in which atheism was a law of the state. He found that every force of importance in the country was on his side. Everything was done that was conceivable to humiliate and to discourage religious observance. Everything was done to cause young people to become highly fact-minded. Russia at that time was engaged in the beginning of a great struggle for industrial and economic supremacy. In that struggle, priests and monks and nuns did not look particularly helpful. Therefore, as far as possible, they were drawn back into industrial society. They were forced either to take secular employment or else to hazard actual existence. And in the state, the scientist was looked up to because he was free from all of these morbid superstitions. One point, of course, we have to remember that they learned. While they were able to do a great deal to oppose religious belief, the most recent estimates that are possible to obtain on the subject indicate that there are still between 50 and 60 million devout believers in Russia. And by this I don't mean devout believers in communism. I mean devout believers in religion, most of them belonging to the Russian Orthodox Church. Now, this in itself is a scientific marvel, and even the scientists have begun to meditate upon it. How is it possible to stamp out religion systematically for 40 years and have it still there? Not only there, but all of a sudden showing signs of great reviving, shall we say, vitality. Now, we all know what the trouble is in this particular point. While we have been worrying to death about the Russians sending bombs over here some night when we were not looking, they have been well telling their own people the same story. They have told their own people that these nasty capitalistic nations might bomb them at any moment. The result has been a strong religious revival in Russia. Not incredible, but interesting. In this moment of great personal peril, the average Russian has not turned to the Kremlin or the party, for he suspects he will find the other members of the party in the next shelter with him. Now comes the great question, if we are all going to be blown to perdition, what matters it whether we belong to the party or not? So Russia is beginning to get a little uneasy about some of these things. And this uneasiness is marked by a double manifestation that is arising. One phase of which is the reviving of the religious life of the Russian people. And in this, religion is playing it rather smart, because the new Metropolitan of Russia is now working out a program to make the church compatible with progress, with scientific progress. In other words, it is not necessary now for you to hold a dichotomy against science in order to be religious. This is an interesting little development, but it is something that we are also experiencing, but more slowly. Actually, Russian materialistic science is about 20-25 years ahead of us, because it had such a beautiful type of background in which to function. It inherited a great many of the disgruntled German scientists after World War II. These gentlemen, living in their own curious intellectual isolation, devoted their time to the advancing of the various pursuits of science and knowledge, and they gathered together in a strong little band with no one to ridicule them, everyone cheering for them, everyone certain that they were good party members, largely because they didn't believe in anything, including the party, which we now begin to realize is true. So without any opposition from quiet and firm believers who still paid taxes and patronized universities, the Russian materialistic scientists went all out in their materialism. Now it seems that they are all in. There's something has happened. And the thing that has happened there, as here, is that the scientist has lost control of his own skill. He has lost control of his inward power to apply the censorship of morality and ethics to his own productions. He suddenly discovers he's a one-track mind, and that one-track mind is leading him relentlessly and inevitably to World War III. This is a thought that no longer really makes him very happy. So what could have happened here 20 years ago, 20 years from now, if we had continued as we were, is now happening in Russia, which, because of its peculiar structure, enabled its scientists to attain a position of dominance which we have not permitted ours to attain. So at this time, we notice on both sides of the Atlantic a growing sense that a serious mistake has been made. This growing sense is perhaps due partly to fear, but it is also due partly to the actual progress which science has made. There are indications that science is outgrowing its own materialism. It is reaching a point in its studies of universal phenomena in which it can no longer remain materialistic. I suppose to some scientists this will be an unhappy discovery, and some will probably never accept it. Others, however, who are truly scientific in their thinking, will not only accept it, but will do something about it. We have already learned psychologically that materialism as a basis of human security is a dead loss. We have also learned that scientific aptitudes are no substitute for moral convictions. In almost every area here, we are waking up to the fact that what we call materialism is a dead loss to all concerned. Not only is it a dead loss, but we are no longer in the days of Huxley and Darwin. We are no longer in the early years of Sigmund Freud. We have gone through a lot since those days, and we are no longer convinced that this wild burst of materialistic enthusiasm meant much. It is therefore interesting, in the light of this, to read a little article that appeared in the New York Times on February 7th of this year, which has a little bearing on our subject. This article is by Harrison E. Salisbury, who was the former Moscow correspondent of the New York Times, who recently revisited the Soviet Union and traveled widely in the country. He says, quote, "Within the most advanced echelon of Soviet science, there is emerging a tendency to seek a non-materialistic spiritual concept of the universe." See, they had the chance to go off the deep end. They went well off. Now they have to crawl back. Perhaps from their experience, we may not have to make that dive into foolishness. Back to Mr. Salisbury. "This startling development within the elite core of Soviet society is closely related to two collateral tendencies: a new and vigorous Communist Party drive against religious beliefs, and a reform move within the Russian Orthodox Church to adapt itself to modern technological society. The fact that some of the most brilliant Soviet scientists suggest that there must exist in the universe a force or power that is superior to any possessed by man is said to have shocked conventionally minded Communist Party functionaries." My, how easily they are shocked. "How widespread this tendency is cannot be established, for names have not been given. But there is reason to believe that some of the most eminent figures in the galaxy of Soviet physicists, astronomers, and mathematicians are involved. They are men of great influence. It may be presumed that the tendency that they represent will not long be confined to the field of science. These men have not become believers in a formal religion or dogma. Their faith is more akin to that appearing among many of their Western scientific colleagues, but they are no longer atheists." This is a rather light statement of it, but the translations that are being made by the United States government of Soviet and Red Chinese scientific publications supplies us with many of the names that are not mentioned here. The big names are in the movement. Now, it isn't so important, perhaps, to us that these are Russians. Perhaps it is important. But we must remember that the scientific world is a level of itself. Russian scientists, German scientists, French scientists, American scientists, Hindu scientists all speak the same language. They are all concerned with the same basic attitudes. We are therefore dealing with an upheaval within a strata, within one of the several levels of our higher intellectualism, and to the average Western person today, one of the highest levels. This marked reversal of opinion, which is also appearing more and more among our own scientific leaders, may tell us something that is important for us to remember, namely, that science will ultimately, must ultimately, learn certain things about the universe which are incompatible with what we know today as atheism. This will throw the scientist into a quandary and into a dilemma. We cannot expect, and have no reason to expect, that scientists will go back to any formal theology now generally held in the world. Some will go back symbolically, because wherever there is a sudden revulsion against an extreme attitude, this revulsion may cause the individual to return to the opposite extreme. But broadly speaking, the trend is not from science to theology, but from science to a new concept of divine providence, or a new understanding of universal realities. James Jeans made that swing some time ago. It wasn't particularly well received in the West. It was considered that he was merely getting to be an elderly gentleman. When Dr. Millikan did the same thing, he was regarded with some pity and considerable disfavor from among his own group. These were simply men ahead of their time. But the sober fact remains that when the top group of the scientific world begins to think this way, the inevitable result is going to be a complete reshuffling of our attitude towards life and our attitude toward the universe and our attitude ultimately toward our fellow men. Looking over some of the information that is now gradually developing, we find one clear statement appearing in Western scientific thinking, that we must get rid forever of this dichotomy of God and nature, of heaven and earth, of God and man. These dichotomies are not any longer valid, and science is already moving toward the position in which a complete unity of life fact is becoming obvious. In other words, what we would term the universe is merely God in motion. It is not a different thing. Man is actually the universe in motion also. There is only one tremendous, all-controlling agency. All things exist in this agency and are of it. And what we have called various divisions, setting up arbitrary terms to divide the universe into an infinite fragmentation, this is now regarded scientifically as improper. That whatever we are going to have, whatever we are going to discover, we're going to discover one eternal principle, one eternal fact. One immutable, inevitable power. And we're going to discover as we go along that this immutable power cannot be mindless, cannot be merely mechanistic, that this power is not merely fuel in a tank. This power is not merely some form of superior electricity arising merely from the friction of space or something of that nature. This power obviously is revealed through its own production. And it produces something from itself that reveals beyond any question or doubt that it is also omniscient. So we are now beginning to be aware in science that we must either find or postulate this primary mover of all things. That we must recognize that this great plan of things must, by its own evidence, bear witness to the planner of this thing. When we didn't know too much about the universe, the plan didn't seem as large as it does now. But when we go into electronics and things of this degree of intensity, we become more and more aware of the immutables of law and process. We become more and more aware of the incredible potential of existence itself. Our forebears, scratching a hazardous existence from the earth, did not know these things. They knew it rained, and they knew the floods came, and that it snowed. And also they knew that the harvest would come in proper season, all other things being reasonable. But they had no concept of what we know today. They had no concept of what is now the common knowledge of a laboratory research technician. He lives in a world that is more than he can comprehend. He is surrounded by other people who are penetrating into various aspects of it, as he is. There is scarcely a day when a great discovery is not made, but tomorrow there will be another. And this process of infinite discovering does not seem to come to any end. We do not find the discovery that ends all discovery. All we ever find is a discovery that leads to more discovery. This kind of a universe really becomes too big for the individual to estimate with the limited faculties at his own disposal. He is therefore forced almost to an attitude which we would term one of veneration, and which materialists term one of superstition. He is led to come to the rather obvious conclusion that in the universe everything is possible. In the universe there is no way of even guessing what ultimates will be. To face this kind of a universe and face it merely as a machine or a mechanized organism becomes less and less possible. The individual must either be lost in this, or he must affirm and assume his own place in it. And in order to protect himself from his overwhelming insignificance, man must begin to include himself in the great universal processes which go on around him. Little by little, therefore, the scientific mind is coming face to face with too much evidence of an intelligent, conscious universe. He has not experienced this consciousness or this intelligence, but he beholds it. He receives the testimony of it through his sensory perceptions. He is surrounded by it. And as his own experiments go on, he becomes more aware of how invisible, incredible forces can and do operate continuously. The Russians have found this. They have also made the negative discovery, which we are also making today, and that is that man himself is so constituted in his own psychic organism that he flourishes only when his integrities are reasonably secure. Man has to have faith. As one of the old Greeks said, man is a religious animal. Man has within himself the inevitable determination to believe. And the reason he has this determination is that it is essential to his survival. Long before man can hope to comprehend the mystery of the universe, he must assume it. He must accept it. And out of a very simple childlike faith, he must take hold of universal phenomena and see in it hope rather than despair. He cannot live in a universe composed entirely of mechanistic factors, because himself he is not a machine. If he had no intuition, if he had no emotion, if he had no inward hopes and aspirations that transcend the actual mechanistic problems of survival, if he did not have these, he might be content to live in a universe made up of machines. But man is not so constituted. He is not content. We have only one way of knowing at our level of insight whether man is right or wrong. This old process of dogmatizing these things is not especially practical, although we must admit that in old dogma there is much truth sometimes, but also there is tendency to error. The only thing that we can be perfectly sure of is that nature's processes support those that are consistent with them. That creatures, in order to enjoy the maximum security in any natural situation, must obey the laws of that situation. If they wish to become wiser, it means that they must become wiser in relation to these laws. If they wish to contribute to progress, they must help to advance these laws, not some other laws. Man, therefore, experiences a twofold destiny. He finds that some of the things that he does make him better, make him happier, healthier, lengthen his life, give him a more serene existence here. Other things which he does obviously are not according to nature's will, and he is promptly punished. He is punished in various ways. Most of all, he is deprived of the support of nature. He finds that his affairs do not go well. He finds that his health is disturbed. His emotions are disturbed. His mind is disturbed. He discovers that if he keeps the laws around him, keeps faith with something, this faith sustains and supports him. If he breaks faith with this thing, it turns upon him and apparently persecutes him. Actually, however, merely depriving him of his birthright of a place in nature's program of progress. Thus, we have one simple criterion that we can use again and again. Are we able to survive what we do? Is this thing which we are doing contributing to progress? If it is, it is contributing to good. It is contributing to happiness. It is contributing to well-being. If what we do does not contribute to some constructive end and does not bear a good fruit, then what we are doing is not right. So psychologists, taking this hint, which the physicists have tossed to them, have now come to the conclusion that when you take man and take his religion away from him, get rid of all his superstitions and polish him up thoroughly, instead of being a nice, happy person, he's just a hopeless neurotic. They have found out that when you try to tell the individual that his beliefs are no good, that he should outgrow them. He may accept your remark and pine away almost immediately. He is not any better. Time and time again, the individuals who have gone to a materialistic psychologist for help have left without help, perhaps even worse off because they've lost faith in something. This is becoming so obvious throughout the field that the psychologist is forced to come, as several have recently, to the simple conclusion that belief in God is part of human health. And if you haven't got it, you're sick. Now, this is far more important than whether you can prove it theologically or not, because there is no proof that is more immediately interesting to the individual than that which is registered in his own blood pressure. If he finds, as most have found, that a reasonable, normal belief helps to make life meaningful, then this individual has found this part of natural truth. And he finds that this part of natural truth is valuable to him. Science also is forced to look, at least give a quick side glance, to the result of the materializing of human society. It sees now that nearly every institution that is important to the survival of man has been undermined by lack of ethics. The scientist is beginning to recognize that in the name of science and in the name of scientific procedure, he is hazarding the very survival of science. He is creating a world which will use science to destroy itself and science with it. Thus, the thoughtful scientist himself, particularly the scientific historian, is forced to admit that materialism has been a dismal failure, a noble experiment, and in no way worth saving. Now, this means, of course, that a world scientifically trained must seek a different kind of approach to religion than that of a world which was not so trained. And here the mention that we made of the effort of the Russian Orthodox Church to meet the challenge of a technological society is worth giving another thought to. Apparently, the Russian Orthodox Church is convinced that it can save religion without depending upon the old armament of religious dogmas. And I think they're probably quite right, because it was the old armament that was destroying religion, just as it is the new materialism that was destroying science. Out of this must then arise the concept of a religion that is suitable to the man of today and the man of tomorrow. A religion in which there is no conflict between theology and science. This type of unification should be possible because it has actually been accomplished in the private lives of many people. It is not as difficult or terrible a reconciliation as we might at first suppose. It simply means that the individual begins to interpret his universe in terms of meaning as well as merely in terms of matter. The moment you add meaning to matter, you have conviction of some kind, and conviction we must have. One of the big problems that faces science today in the matter of conviction is also its long, dramatic struggle against the delusion of immortality. Scientists have become actually enraged at the stupidity of people who insist that they want to live after they're dead. What could be more utterly ridiculous and what could be more utterly unscientific? Well, I can think of things that perhaps would fall into that classification, but we don't need to pause with them. The fact now comes out that everybody is worried about this. For example, nearly everybody in the world, politically at least, has got an ideology of some kind that they are trying to foist upon mankind. The communists want a communist world. The proletarians of other nations want their private brand of proletarianism. Western nations want their particular type. And every country has some kind of a remedy for the ills of man which it wishes to popularize. We are convinced the democratic way of life is good. Whether we call it a republic or a democracy, this is what we've got. And we are beginning to view very favorably the idea of an eternal welfare state. But one problem seems to put a fly in the ointment. What does it all mean if no one is going anywhere? No one is ever going to know it or not. And no one is ever ultimately going to care what we had or how we got it or whether we kept it or lost it. The whole thing is rounded by such a futility that it's getting more and more difficult to live with ourselves. Now the prospect or possibility of being blown up in our scientific prime also makes a certain cause of apprehension. The scientist himself, where is he going? If he is the victim of a direct hit, where is he? What difference does it make whether he graduated Phi Beta Kappa or flunked the course? He can say, well, if I graduated cum laude, at least my friends were all glad about it. And as a result of that, I was able to attain a higher social dignity. Everyone called me Herr Professor or Doctor. But realize that after he's blown up, he's not even going to remember what they called him. Now the communist peoples are building a new world order. They are going to make the world safe for the proletarian. They're going to have 5-year plans and 10-year plans and nobody knows how many year plans in order that a great idea, the idea of Marx and Engels, shall ultimately wave its banner triumphantly over the earth. Do these people realize that if this happens, they're not even going to know about it? We're going to have this great socialized country, which is the fulfillment of our desires. It may not be anything our descendants want, but we think they do. But we're not going to know it. So we pass it on to them. We're not building for our own frail mortality. We are building for the future. Now we suddenly wonder about the frail mortality of the future. All our children, and their children to eternity are also all going to stop remembering that they ever existed. So that actually our memory is just a little span of years. Then there isn't anything. And no one will know, no one will care, and we will not know nor care. There will be no evidence in space whether we came before or after the dinosaur. But we will be as dead as the dinosaur. So, with this general thinking, we have a tremendous futility. I know one scientist got rather excited about it when he suddenly realized that according to the best calculations, the planet is not going to last more than another 10 or 20 billion years. At the end of that time, all progress will go up in smoke, steam, or whatever is used to terminate planets. There isn't any more. And in face of this famous line, there isn't any more. What are we all getting excited about? What is the end of this thing? And science can no longer tell us that the great victory is a full stomach. Men can die on a full stomach also. And when they're dead, they will not know whether their stomach was full or not. When we rest, as Omar said, with the world's last 7,000 years, who cares? What are we doing?